Okay, Proverbs chapter 22. A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold. It's better to have a name of integrity than have lots of riches. Some of the stuff, you know, as you read through it, I can't help but think of a lot of the newspaper headlines lately, you know. I don't know. Martha Stewart, the name, you know, people fall on either side when you raise up the name. But I think she would probably agree with this right now. A good name is rather to be had than great riches. You know, it's important, a name, being a man or woman of integrity. Verse 2, the rich and poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of them all. That's something that folks who struggle with prejudice often forget, that we all have one maker, no matter who we are, rich or poor. Verse 3, a prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. A prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. I was thinking about the hurricanes. And, every time you turn on one of the news channels, that's all you're seeing, you know, the last couple of months, it seems like, is another hurricane coming. And hurricanes come with plenty of warnings nowadays. It's not like anybody gets caught off guard. And now they predict 2-3 days ahead of time exactly where it's, you know, or within a couple, you know, 50, 20, whatever, 100 miles, where it's going to hit, you know. This latest one, Ivan, I think it's pounding the coast. It should be hitting around now, another hour or two, is when the eye is supposed to hit near Mobile, Alabama. And this thing is like packing 160-mile-an-hour continuous winds, gusts up to close to 200 miles an hour. Waves, they've spotted waves 45 feet high. Storm surge, meaning the tide is 20 feet above normal. I mean, it's just incredible. They're worrying about New Orleans, which is built behind levees below sea level, and all it's got to do is just get up over the levees, and the town is flooded, totally flooded. It's gonna be interesting what Ivan leaves behind. But even despite all these warnings, and even despite having, you know, Charlie go through Florida, Francis go through Florida, there's still people who want to tough it out, you know. And I think about this. A prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, and the simple pass on and are punished. You know, the prudent man pays attention to the warnings. Pays attention to the warnings. What kind of things do you and I get warnings about? Things that affect us. Let me hear from you. But what kind of things do you and I get warnings about that we ought to pay attention to? We talk about terror warnings, right? Terror alerts. Sure, that's something the whole nation thinks about. You know, is it orange or red and stuff like that? But what are other things? What are the things that that people get warnings about that we ought to pay attention to? Yes. Yes, I've gotten both of those. Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. And the prudent man does something about it. Does something about it. Don't let it go by. What are other things we get warnings about?
You get lights on your desk when your car to change the oil.
There you go. There you go. Sure. Yeah, the engine light goes on or something. Sure, absolutely. You know, some people ignore the warnings of substance abuse, whether it's watching a loved one get hooked on prescription drugs or alcohol or the illegal stuff. And we see the warning signs, and some people choose to put their head in the sand and pretend it's not there. No, don't. Do something about it. What are the things? Kids behavior? Absolutely. You got to pay attention to it. You've got to pay attention to it. Got to pay attention to what's going on in your kids. You got to keep a finger on the pulse. of things. Financial issues, you know, when we can't rein in the finances when we need to. I was thinking about in marriage. Thinking about how in marriage, if we don't keep a finger on the pulse of our marriages, we kind of drift apart. And then suddenly people slam into a brick wall and they wonder, what happened? Well, there were warning signs. There's usually always warning signs. And here Solomon says, a prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself. He does something about it. The simple pass on and are punished. Ignore the warnings. So how do you respond to warnings? Do you ignore them? Do you laugh at them? Do you make excuses? Or do you want to do something about the problems? Pay attention to the warnings. Verse 4. By humility and fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life. Verse 5. Thorns and snares are in the way of the froward or the perverse. He that doth keep his soul shall be far from them. I was thinking earlier today, I was thinking about, I wonder how many less thorns I'd have stuck in the bottom of my foot if I took some of the perverse things in my life out. Things that I expose myself to that allow perversity, wickedness into my mind. I wonder how many less splinters I'd have to be walking around on. It's kind of nice to get some of the evil, yucky voices and pictures out of your head, isn't it? Verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. There's a great verse. I'll spend a few minutes talking about this. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, this verse is often used by people, I think, in not a good way, where people will say, well, you teach your children about the Lord, and then even if they fall away, they'll come back to the Lord. And that's what it's talking about. And I hope that were the case, and I would love to believe with you and pray with you for your kids. If your kids are away from the Lord, but I'm not sure that that's what this is a promise about. And there are many. I mean, it's not an unknown thing that a family will raise a child, teaching them about the Lord, and a child will fall away, and they don't come back. It says, "Train up a child in the way he should go." A better translation of this verse, a more accurate literal translation, is, train up a child according to his particular way. Train up a child according to his particular way. Each of us has a certain bent in life. We have things that we're good at, things that we like, things that we don't like. What did they say it was? That strengths book that we were reading. I think they say by age 16, you're locked in for life. But like from age 3 to 16, you start developing these patterns in your life of things that you're better at than others. And all kinds of different traits. And you and I, as parents, our job is to study our kids. Our job is to find out the things that they are good at, to find their way for them. It says, train up a child according to his way. Find out what your kid's good at, what their bent is, and then to encourage that. Show them the things that they're good at, and then they can flourish. If a child is good at numbers or science, you encourage them in that stuff. You let them flourish in it. If your kid's good with people, they've got good social skills, you develop those things. If a kid has strengths in creative, artistic things, then you help them develop in those areas. A gal named Ruth Stafford Peale gives this advice, encouraging the uniqueness in her children. She says this, the secret is this, watch to see where a child's innate skills or talents lie. Then gently, do not expect too much too soon, gently lead or coax him or her in those areas. It may be difficult for a father who was a crack athlete to understand and help a son who would rather play chess than football. I mean, that's tough. But chess, not football, is what that boy needs. If confidence is to grow in him, if he does that one thing well, he will come to believe that he can do other things well, and he won't be afraid to attempt them. Children are encouraged when we affirm their originality. Some kids are athletic, some aren't. Some are musical, some aren't. Some are introverts, others are extroverts. They're all different, and they're all gifts to us from God. They're all a heritage from the Lord. We need to take time to understand who our kids are, and then to cultivate that. A waitress was taking orders from a young couple and their son. She was one of the class of veteran waitresses who never show outright disrespect to their customers, but who frequently make it quietly evident by their unhurried pace and their level stare that they fear no mortal, not even parents. She jotted on her order pad deliberately and silently as the father and mother gave their luncheon selection and gratuitous instructions as to what was to be substituted for what and which dressing changed to what sauce. When she finally turned to the boy, he began his order with a kind of fearful desperation. I want a hot dog, he started. And both parents barked at once, "No hot dog!" The mother went on, "Bring him the lyonnaise potatoes and the beef, both vegetables, a hard roll, and..." The waitress wasn't even listening. She said evenly to the youngster, "What do you want on your hot dog?" He flashed an amazed smile. "Ketchup, lots of ketchup, and bring a glass of milk." "Coming up," she said as she turned from the table, leaving behind her the stunned silence of utter parental dismay. The boy watched her go before he turned to his father and mother with astonished elation to say, "You know what? She thinks I'm real. She thinks I'm real." You know, that's it, gang. That's now, you know, don't argue with me about the hot dog thing. That, you know, okay, I'm not trying to push hot dogs. But you get the gist of it. And it's not about kids having their own way, no. But it's about hearing what your kids are good at. It's about cultivating the things that are good in your kids. And you know what, gang? That takes time. It takes work. It takes spending time with your kids. And so, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Verse 7, "The rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is the servant to the lender." In other words, we are all enslaved to our credit card companies. That's what he's saying. You are the slave of your credit card company. Verse 8, "He that soweth iniquity shall reap vanity," or emptiness. The rod of his anger shall fail. Verse 9, "He that hath a bountiful eye shall be blessed, for he giveth of his bread to the poor." In other words, we've seen this over and over again. It's important to learn to be generous, to care for the poor. Verse 10, "Cast out the scorner, and contention shall go out." I like this verse. "Yea, strife and reproach shall cease." Cast out the scorner, and contention shall go out. Yea, strife and reproach shall cease. The word that's translated scorner carries the idea to scorn, to talk arrogantly, to mock, to deride. Now the translation says, "Throw out the mocker, and fightings, quarrels, and insults will disappear." Now the translation, "Get rid of the person who makes fun of wisdom, then fighting, quarrels, and insults will stop." You know, there's something about, and I see it in my own life, where I develop what I call a critical spirit. And I get this thing going in me where all I'm grading everybody around me. You know, and I'm giving everybody demerits. Don't give anybody bonus points. I only give demerits, you know. And you know what? It does nothing but stir up trouble. It does. Long time ago, I wrote a song called "Critical Spirit, Depart from Me." Precious Jesus, come set me free from judging others, grumbling, and sanctimonious pride. Precious Jesus, come set me free. And every once in a while, I got to pull that song out and sing it to myself. Because I just go overboard with a critical spirit. I understand from psychology classes that when I'm critical of others, it's usually because I'm not feeling good about me. You know, I'm feeling pretty lousy about me. Maybe somebody's been critical of me. But look at this verse, gang. Cast out the scorner, and contention shall go out. You know, stop the criticizing. Get rid of the critical one. And sometimes the critical one's the guy that's staring at you in the mirror, or the gal that's staring at you in the mirror. Me. I'm not staring at you in the mirror. A salesman visiting his barber for a haircut mentioned that he was about to take a trip to Rome. The barber, who came from Italy, said, "Rome is a terribly overrated city. What airline are you taking and what hotel are you staying at?" When the salesman told him, the barber criticized the airline for being undependable and the hotel for having horrible service. He told him, "You'd be better off to stay at home." But the salesman insisted, I'm expecting to close a big deal, and then I'm going to see the Pope." The barber shook his head and said, "You'll be disappointed trying to do business in Italy, and I wouldn't count on seeing the Pope. He only grants audiences to very important people." 2 months later, the salesman returned to the barbershop. The barber asked, "And how was your trip?" The salesman replied, "It's wonderful. The flight was perfect. The service at the hotel was excellent. I made a big sale and I got to see the Pope." The barber was astounded. "You got to see the Pope? What happened?" "I bent down and kissed his ring."
"No kidding. What did he say?"
"Well, he looked down at my head and then he said to me, 'My son, where did you get such a lousy haircut?'" Okay, that was it. Verse 11. No, but 10. "Cast out the scorner, and contention shall go out. Yea, strife and reproach shall cease." Verse 11. "He that loveth pureness of heart, for the grace of his lips, the king shall be his friend." He that loveth pureness of heart, for the grace of his lips, the king shall be his friend. Another translation, a person who loves innocent thoughts and kind words will have even the king as a friend. Let me read that again. A person who loves innocent thoughts and kind words will have even the king as a friend. I don't know. From time to time, I find people who say, I'm looking for friends. I want friends. This would be a great verse to share with them, wouldn't it? You know, I wish I had friends. We get prayer requests. You know, people, we've gotten a couple of them over the last 6 months where somebody will say, you know, I wish I would be a nicer person so I can make friends. Another person said, I wish I had some Christian girlfriends. I live alone, you know, and I wish I had friends. Well, here's some great tips on how to get a friend. A person who loves innocent thoughts and kind words will have even the king as a friend. So you work on your thoughts, your mind, your heart. Try to clean it up. If you're having a hard time cleaning it up, get in the Bible, take a bath. When a person gets some pretty dirty, yucky, ucky thoughts going through their heads, you know, I think one of the best things you can do is to get out your Bible and start reading. I'll tell you what, it's just like pulling the plug on the dirty thoughts. They go right out away. They go right out the door. Get a pure heart. Get an innocent heart. Let God wash your heart. And then, work at saying kind things to others. A person who loves innocent thoughts and kind words. Learn to say kind things to others. Dave, you remember years ago at Calvary Anaheim, when we did Sunday nights, that fellow named Richard, who like an ex-street person, and he had a long beard, and he kind of sat by himself, and he'd come up to me after every service, and he would tell me what was wrong with my message. And the first time it happened, I was like, oh, well, gosh, I'm so sorry. I'll be really careful about that, you know, and I really did not mean to make it. I'm sorry, I didn't realize I said that, you know, or I didn't mean, you know, and I, well, you know, and we talk about scriptures, you know, and then it happened again, and I was thinking, wow, he's really paying attention. I don't know if I like him paying that kind of attention, you know, and he'd tell me the things that were wrong. And it was like every week he'd show up. He'd come up after the service to tell me about the things. He'd write down verses, you know, and, well, you know, this would be a better verse, or, you know, you shouldn't have quoted this here, you know, or like this. And it would get to the point where I'd almost like go into an anxiety attack when we, you know, Dave and I would lead worship, and he'd come and sit in the back, and I'd go, you know, it's like, oh, my gosh, I hope I studied hard enough, you know, and I hope I don't leave anything open for criticism, you know. And then there he'd come at the end of the service, and I'd be thinking, oh, gosh, here it comes, you know. And I believe I came to understand that in watching him over the months, he's a lonely guy, never came with anybody else, always came by himself, that I recall. And, you know, I was the only person he ever talked to. And I think that that's just is the only thing he could think of to talk about was the message and what was wrong with it. And I just kind of got to the point where I started having a little more compassion on him because I realized he was a lonely person. But I'll tell you what made me want to run away, you know. And so look at this. What a great verse to share with folks who are looking for friends. Folks, we're feeling lonely. Two things you can do. Clean up your heart and say kind things. You know, let God wash your heart. Think about pure thoughts. Think about, I love this. It's the International Children's Bible I keep quoting to you. It says, a person who loves innocent thoughts and kind words will have even the king as a friend. Isn't that a great principle? What a great principle. That'd be a great principle for us to teach our kids, you know, how to have friends, the right kind of friends. Verse 12, the eyes of the Lord preserve knowledge, and he overthroweth the words of the transgressor. Verse 13, the slothful man saith, there is a lion without, I shall be slain in the streets. You get it? Let me read that one again. The slothful, the lazy man, saith, there's a lion without, there's a lion outside, I shall be slain in the streets. The lazy man, the guy that never does anything. This is his excuse. Oh, there's lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my. You know, there's lions out there, so I can't do anything. I got to stay in here under my covers. Making excuses. Do you have excuses why you do things? Do you have excuses why you don't do things? The Bible's got all kinds of great examples of some of the world's bestest excuses. When Adam got caught, what was his excuse? She did it. And actually, I think he even went beyond that. I think he even blamed God a little bit because he said, it was the woman that you gave me. Not my fault. That's where Rocket Man was. It was Rocket Man or whatever. It's not my fault. Not my fault. I didn't do it. Wasn't me. Yeah, it wasn't me. Yeah. It was the woman you gave me. Yeah. And I think the bestest one of all time is Aaron. You know, in Exodus 32, the golden calf. You know, and Moses comes down because God says, you know, there's trouble down there. You better go down and take care of it, son. And Moses says, okay, God. And he goes down and the people are having this wild party and Moses walks up to his older brother and says, bro, what's going on? And Aaron goes, oh, I you know, what's golden calf? And Aaron goes, well, let me read to you. This is King James. No, no, this New Living Translation. Well, they said to me, make us some gods to lead us, for something has happened to this man Moses. In other words, it's your fault, you were so late. So I told them, bring me your gold earrings. And when they brought them, I threw them into the fire, and out came this calf. It's a miracle. Here's a miracle. I just threw it in, and out came the calf. We're no different. We all make excuses. Negotiations between union members and their employer were at an impasse. The union denied that their workers were flagrantly abusing their contract sick leave provisions. You guys never do that. You never do that. One morning at the bargaining table, the company's chief negotiator held aloft the morning edition of the newspaper. This man, he announced, called in sick yesterday. There on the sports page was a photo of the supposedly ill employee who had just won a local golf tournament with an excellent score. Silence was in the room. It was broken by the union negotiator. Wow, he said. Think what kind of score he could have had if he hadn't been sick. George Washington Carver said, you know who George Washington Carver was? He said, 99% of failures come from people who have the habit of making excuses. Carver was no stranger to adversity and could have easily made excuses for not succeeding, but that wasn't his way. Despite being born into slavery, he rose above his circumstances. He earned a B.S., then an M.S. in agriculture from Iowa State College, dedicated himself to teaching poor African-American farmers. He developed an extensive program at Alabama's Tuskegee Institute to take the classroom to the people in the South, teaching agriculture methods and home economics. His research resulted in the development of hundreds of products from crops such as peanuts and sweet potatoes. He did all that despite working with limited resources and opportunities because of segregation. Where others might have offered excuses, Carver achieved excellence. So, something didn't happen. You did something wrong. You didn't do something the way you should have. You could have done something, but you didn't. Why? Do you have an excuse? Do I hide behind my excuse? You know, the Bible says if we just confess our sins, He's faithful and just to forgive us and to cleanse us. You know what? I hope I can stop hiding behind my excuses. And hey, if I blew it, I blew it. And let's move on. Let's keep trying. Don't let the lions, tigers, and bears outside keep you from doing what you ought to do. The slothful man saith, there's a lion without, I shall be slain in the streets. Verse 14, the mouth of a strange woman is a deep pit. He that is abhorred of the Lord shall fall therein. Now, I guess you could probably find out which gal is the strange woman by asking her to open her mouth and measure it. Because it says it's a deep pit. I don't think that's what it's talking about. Two other translations. One says the mouth of an immoral woman is a deep pit. Those living under the Lord's displeasure will fall into it. Another translation, the words of an unfaithful wife are like a deep trap. Those who make the Lord angry will get caught by them. And you know what? We don't have to just talk about bad women because it works both ways. It works both ways. We can get caught by people who are wicked. Verse 15. Oh, love this verse. Amen. This is a great verse. I've taught this one to my children. foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. It's talking about spanking. I know I could probably get arrested for saying this nowadays, but I believe that spanking is sometimes appropriate. And I believe that sometimes some of our families are hurting because we have not taken advantage of some of the tools that God has given us. Ruth Graham talks about the appropriateness of when it's appropriate to spank, and she says, with our five children, I had to decide what was a moral issue and what was non-moral and simply a part of growing up. Tracking mud into the house is a no-no, but it's not a moral issue. Right? Children tend to be noisy when they're playing, and you feel like saying hush, but it's not a moral issue. However, I would call disobedience a moral issue. I would call respect a moral issue. Of course, stealing and lying are moral issues. You understand that there's differences. And when it comes to spanking, I don't think that spanking is something we should do. We should be a part of non-moral issues. But I think that there are times where we need to teach our children discipline. Sometimes spanking is the proper response. When one of my children responds to a situation with total rebellion and malice, this verse comes to mind. And I have told my children from time to time, I will sit them down and I will tell them, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. I can see it right there in your heart, and we're going to drive it far from you. We're going to do this together. My personal theory, and it's holding up so far, my personal theory is you need to start early, because if you let it go too long, it's hard to catch up. I believe if you wait until they're teenagers to begin to deal with foolishness issues in the heart, I imagine it could be pretty hard. I want to give you some tips on spanking. This is Pastor Rich's 8 tips on spanking. These are things that we have learned and so far are holding up to be true. I was listening to one of Chuck's messages, and he was talking about, you know, 40 years ago when he and Kay were first starting out, how he used to, you know, do sermons on raising children and that exactly this is how you raise children and stuff. That was before they had any children. And he says, now that we've had all our kids and they're all grown up, I don't know a thing about raising kids. And I kind of understand that. So I want you to understand, this is just, so far this is working. So far this is working. Tips on spanking. Number one, how old should a child be when you start spanking? I believe that a child should be old enough to understand what's going on. I think people who start spanking their children when they're 3 months old or something like that, I think that that's wrong. I think you're not teaching anything. I believe your child needs to be able to communicate with you. I believe that they need to be able to talk to you, that tell you that they did wrong. If they're not old enough to tell you that they did something wrong, I think you need to wait. I think you need to find another way of changing the behavior. Number two, how old is too old for spanking? Well, I don't know. I'm not sure we've reached that yet. I haven't spanked him in a long time. I haven't spanked my. In fact, to tell you the truth, I don't recall when the last time was that I spanked our children. In fact, there was an incident we got really close while Mommy was gone. We got really close, and I threatened one of the persons in our household with the paddle, but I couldn't find it. But it's okay, because he saw the look on my face, he saw that I was serious, and he changed his behavior. So, by the way, do you know where the paddle is since we moved? I don't know. I know a good friend who had teenage sons who would spank his teenage sons. Not all of them, But he had one in particular who's now a pastor. He had one teenage son who was rebellious in high school, and he would spank his sons from time to time, not all the time, but it happened, and that son has turned out quite well. He's a pastor today, so I think he did okay. Number three, a paddle is better than a hand. That's my personal opinion. I know there's different theories on this, but if you spank with your hand too much, I think to me this makes sense. If you spank with your hand too much, your child begins to associate your hand as the tool of punishment. And you might start reaching out to hug them, and they pull back because there's the hand. I believe that I like the idea. We picked this up. I don't know where we picked this up from, but I don't know, Dr. Sears or something. But the idea, you let something else be the bad thing. We chose the paddle ball paddles because they're big. Oh, they're scary looking. Not the little ping pong paddles. I mean the paddle ball, beach paddle ball paddles are like this. Drew a little happy face on it. And at our old house, it would reside on top of the microwave oven. It had a place. You keep it out of sight so that it's not like it's always staring at the child. But on the other hand, they know where it is. And many times when they understand that you're serious about something, you just start for the paddle. And they understand that you're going to follow through. And they will change their behavior. So I like the idea of having something other than a hand. I know there's different theories on that. Number four, never use the paddle when you're angry. There have been times when I've grabbed the paddle and I'm totally, totally upset with the child. And God gave me enough grace to not use it on the child. I kind of developed a pattern. When I got really angry, I'd go get the paddle and I'd spank myself really, really hard and just spank that anger right out of me. It's like, whew, okay, I'm going to calm down, you know, because I just got this pent up stuff. And you know what? I am not going to take it out on my child. If you are angry when you discipline your child, you got to back off and you need to learn to calm down. Because if you are disciplining your child in anger, the Bible says God disciplines us because he loves us. And if you discipline your child in anger, you could end up with child abuse. And that's not where this is going. That's not where this is supposed to go. If you are a person who has a hard time controlling your anger, then don't go with the paddle. You're going to have to find something else. Never paddle a child when you're angry. You never hit anything but the bottom, because I believe with my pastor, Pastor Mark, that's what God designed bottoms for. That's why they got lots of extra padding, is right there. So it makes a big sound, stings a little, doesn't hurt them at all. If you are leaving bruises on your children, you got to stop, because that's wrong. But you know what? A little bit redness doesn't hurt anybody. And a little bit of a stinging doesn't hurt anybody. And if they're still laughing at you when you're done spanking, you haven't even begun to hit the surface. I mean, sometimes that's the measure, is whether you see them, whether you see the foolishness departing from the child. And it's not really a laughing thing. The paddle is a tool for instruction, not a weapon of punishment. It's something to get their attention so that you can talk to them about their behavior. That's number four. Number five, only use the paddle in private. Don't embarrass your child in front of others. If at all possible, take them to another room where other members of the family aren't watching. Don't do this in front of the other kids. It will demean them in front of their siblings or in front of other family members. Discipline should be something that you take seriously, but not something that you do to humiliate them. You want to save their face in front of everybody else. And when you're all done, if they're still sniffling and their cheeks are puffy from crying, you know, give them a chance. Don't parade them out in front of everybody, you know. You want to save your child from embarrassment, because the whole point is to teach them the lesson, not to humiliate them. Number six, how often do I spank my children? There were times where we would spank a child a couple times a week. But, you know, the more you stay with it, the more you stay on top of things, the less you need it. And like I mentioned before, I cannot recall when the last time was that a child got a swat. Now, I know my children are older. I've got one 17. My youngest is 11. But I think it's been a couple of years. The older they get, the 17-year-old one hasn't gotten a swat in probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 years. If you discipline early, I think it's better in the long run. Number seven, there's more to discipline than a paddle. You got to find out what works. Paddling, I understand, doesn't work with every child. I guess we were blessed enough that it worked with all three of ours, so I'm glad about that. But you got to find out what works with your kid. The goal is instruction. The goal is discipline. The goal is a change of behavior. If the behavior doesn't change, you got to find something else. You got to find something that works. You got to. Because your goal is, by the time your kid's old enough to move out, your goal is you want to have a child. I want to have a child who has got enough self-discipline that they can handle life. That they're not going to run into trouble with their boss because they don't know how to do what the boss says without bad-mouthing the boss. Where they learn to do what their assignment is without somebody having to stand over them 24 hours a day. We're not there, you know. But I want to be able to launch them out, you know, to be able to stand on their own two feet. That's what I'm hoping we're going to do. We aren't there yet. So, number eight is end with love, not the paddle. The end of the discipline shouldn't be the crying, the stinging, the paddle. The end of discipline is love. To me, if the child doesn't get it, we're not done. If the child, part of discipline is you need to be able to hear the child say in their words what they did and what they did wrong. If they don't get it, if they don't understand why they're being spanked, and don't just accept I get it. No. Tell me what you did. You will be amazed at what they... It doesn't do them any good to get spanked if they think they're spanked because you're just in a bad mood. Or because they chose the wrong flavor of ice cream when they raided the refrigerator. You know, they need to know... They need to be able to say it. You need to be able to hear from them what it is that they did wrong. And then... You need, after, if you see the appropriate sorrow and the appropriate I am sorry stuff, you forgive them and you love on them and you hug them and you kiss them. That's how discipline should end, not with the paddle. It should end with them being able to tell you what they did and you forgiving them and you loving them. The goal is discipline. The goal is not punishment. The goal is training our children, not getting even with them. We want to train them. So, there we go. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. Okay, verse 16. He that oppresseth the poor to increase his riches, and he that giveth to the rich shall surely come to want. So it's not good to oppress people or give bribes to rich people. You know, don't be nice to Donald Trump just to get rich. Okay, verse 17. Bow down. Okay, we're going to start a whole new section, and this is kind of new to me to kind of discover this. We're hitting a new section in Proverbs, starting in verse 17. And I never really saw this before until I was studying it today. Bow down thine ear and hear the words of the wise, and apply thine heart unto my knowledge. For it is a pleasant thing if thou keep them within thee, they shall withal be fitted in thy lips. In other words, pay attention to what I'm going to say now, son, that thy trust may be in the Lord. I have made known to thee this day, even to thee. Have I not written to thee excellent things in counsels and knowledge, that I might make thee know the certainty of the words of truth, that thou mightest answer the words of truth to them that send thee? Now, he's saying, I'm going to give you some things that I want you to pay attention to. These are wise things. These are things from councils. These are from, and we believe that this next section are things that Solomon collected, not things that he came up with, but these are things that Solomon collected from wise people of the day. In verse 20, now, New King James, King James, and New American Standard carry this idea. Have I not written to thee excellent things in counsel? Something like that. I'm writing to you some pretty cool things, so pay attention to this. But New Living Translation, NIV, does anybody have any of those? Did you bring your NIV? What does verse 20 say? It's a little bit. Yeah. Have I not written 30 sayings? Where's the 30 in there? Well, King James translates it excellent things. But I did a little bit of work on it, and the word, actually, the Hebrew word, it's the word for three. And so that's where they get this 30, because it actually means three for some reason. I don't know where the excellent things come from, other than they couldn't figure out where's the 30 things. But I've come across where people have done their homework, and starting in verse 22 and running through chapter 24, verse 22, there's 30 things. So he actually gives a list of 30 groupings of things that he's picked up over the years that he's going to share to his son. So this is just kind of some little trivia thing. It probably doesn't mean anything to you, but I just thought, wow, that's kind of cool. I even numbered these in my Bible. And then starting in verse 23, in chapter 24, verse 23, he says, these things also belong to the wise. And then he gives a whole other list of things. But see, he's gone through his 30 things, and now he's going to start another section. So I just thought this was fascinating because I'd never seen this before. So here he starts his 30 things. Verse 22, he says, rob is number one. Rob not the poor because he is poor, neither oppress the afflicted in the gate, for the Lord will plead their cause and spoil the soul of those that spoil them. So don't hurt poor people, because God will get you. God will get you. Number two is verse 24 and 25. He says, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man thou shalt not go, lest thou learn his ways and get a snare to thy soul. So don't hang with angry people, because you're going to get to be just like them. 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, you know, a bad company corrupts good morals. And so you got to kind of get a little litmus paper and stick it on your friends and find out, are they a little too acidic? You know, are they angry people? Because if they're angry people, you're going to learn to be like them. Verse 26 is the third one. Be not thou one of them that strike hands, or of them that are sureties of debts. If thou hast nothing to pay, why should he take away thy bed from under thee? This surety thing, the striking hands, this is the loan stuff. Don't co-sign on a loan for somebody, because if you're out of money, buddy, and your friend defaults on their loan, they're going to come after you and take your bed out from under you. So again, we've seen that theme all through Proverbs. And verse 28. Eight is the fourth thing. Remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set. Remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set. What's that all about? Any suggestions? Come on, Mr. Geography. Yes. Fence or a boundary. That's how they would mark out properties. You would say, well, my farm starts at the old oak over there in the corner, and it runs along the creek until it gets to the three rocks, you know, and then it goes from the three rocks over to the pine forest, and then it goes from the pine forest over, and somebody, and you write that as your title, your on your deed, you know, and when you go through escrow and you buy this thing, you know, and it has description of the property. Well, one night you go out and you dig up the three rocks. You move it into your neighbor's property and you just got more land. So he says, remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set. Don't go doing that kind of stuff. Don't go cheating on people. That's the idea. And verse 29 is the fifth thing. Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men or average guys. He's not going to be in the company of average people. He's going to be in the company of kings. Diligence. Be diligent at your work. And with that, we're done. Yeehaw! Let's stand and pray.